It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, sex assault victims in Wisconsin are often forced to travel long distances and wait for hours to find the nurses who can help them. We'll find out why and how this could change coming up.
First, Tammy Baldwin and 30 fellow U.S. senators wrote a letter to the Attorney General and the Education Secretary this week. The letter called on the Justice and Education Departments to evaluate compliance with new campus rape prevention measures and to clarify what steps universities should take to prevent sexual violence.
The senators, all Democrats or independents, voiced concern that colleges and universities are failing to comply with the Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act, which aims to combat sexual violence and hold schools accountable.
July 1st marked the one-year anniversary of the amended regulations, which require schools to report sexual assault incidents. But out of more than 11,000 schools, 91% reported no occurrences of sexual assault at all.
That is despite the fact that DOJ and Center for Disease Control data shows that one in five females has been sexually assaulted during the undergrad years.
With us now is Nina Chaudhry, Education Director and Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. Nina, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
So what are these senators asking from the Attorney General and the Education Secretary?
They're asking they're asking the Department of Education and DOJ to provide more guidance to schools to help them with training, prevention efforts, and also figure out why. I think, 91% are reporting no incidents of sexual assault. Is that because students aren't feeling comfortable coming forward? What can schools do to make the climate more welcoming and encourage students to report and get the help that they need?
And it sounds like that reporting statistic that you just said, 91% reporting no incidents at all, is for those senators, it's a red flag. What sorts of things are they worried about when it comes to reporting?
It is definitely a red flag, because when national stats repeatedly show that 20 to 25% of young women are sexually assaulted on college campuses, and you have 91% of schools who are required to report saying that they have no incidents of sexual assault, you worry that students don't feel comfortable coming forward. And we have seen that there are a number of factors that can deter students from coming forward. So often when they see that schools are not handling sexual assault appropriately, they're not investigating as they're required to, or in a number of stories that have been in the news recently, when athletes are getting special protections, for example, or students are being penalized if they've been drinking and they're afraid to come forward because they might be found to have violated other school policies, all of those can deter young women and men from coming forward.
There are a couple of different acts at play here when it comes to what campuses have to comply with. One is the Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act from 2013, and one is the Clery Act. Could you tell us what those are, just briefly, and what they call for?
Sure. Well, the Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act actually amended the Clery Act. So I think the two big laws to know about are, in this space in particular, the Clery Act, which requires colleges and universities to report various crime statistics every year, and the VAWA amendments to them made clear that schools had to report sexual assault information and stalking, dating violence, and domestic violence, in addition to other kinds of campus crimes. The other law that's really important in this space is Title IX, which was passed in 1972. It's the same year, actually, that the National Women's Law Center came into being, and we've been working on that law and trying to enforce it in various areas ever since. And that requires schools to take prompt action when they know of sexual assault, to investigate promptly and thoroughly and fairly, and to provide accommodations for our students while investigations are ongoing to make sure they don't face further harassment or retaliation. So that's a very important law. And unfortunately, what we see is that schools across the country are not meeting their legal obligations.
And what happens to schools who may be found to be not within compliance to the laws you talked about?
Well, under Title IX, the federal government has the authority to stop any federal funding that a school is receiving, but that has never happened in the history of the law. Typically what happens is if a complaint is filed or the Department of Education is investigating on its own, they work with a school to try to get the school into compliance with the law. And schools are usually wanting to enter into agreements to comply.
Right now we're talking with Nina Chaudhry, Education Director and Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. We're talking about a move from some senators to increase accountability for sexual assault on college campuses. And in their letter, one of the things that the letters highlighted was the impact that sexual assault could have on the educations and the lives of the young victims. Particularly, what sorts of concerns did the senators have?
Well, sexual assault is a very serious issue, of course. And I think one thing that, you know, has been in the news recently is that young woman at Stanford who so courageously detailed in her letter to the court the devastating impact that sexual assault has on students. You know, under the law, of course, the law is concerned about ensuring an environment, an educational environment that's free of discrimination. And when students are sexually assaulted and their schools are not providing them with services or helping them change classes or living arrangements as needed and disciplining as warranted students who have been found responsible for sexual assault, then they are contributing to a hostile environment for students where it's very hard to learn, and many students find themselves dropping out or, you know, transferring or any number of things that really interrupt their education and interfere with their education.
Are there any mechanisms in place to determine whether a college or a university is being upfront in their reporting of sexual assaults? In short, how do we know if they're doing it or not?
Well, that's a very good question. People should be looking at the statistics that colleges and universities are putting forward, and as these senators rightly pointed out, when you see zeros or very low numbers that don't seem credible, that's certainly a red flag. You know, there's also, schools are encouraged to conduct campus climate surveys. This is something that the White House and the Department of Ed have provided some guidance on as well. There's a great website called notalone.gov that provides resources and tips and sample climate surveys, and these are intended to really help schools figure out what is going on their particular campus. What do students know about their rights and sexual assault, and what's the perception on campus so that schools can really tailor their prevention and training and figure out what they need to do to make sure that it's a campus where people feel comfortable coming forward and know how to get the help they need.
When you talk about this issue, are there any schools, universities that come to mind that have especially effective programs when it comes to prevention strategies that could be a model for other schools?
That's a really good question. I don't know off the top of my head that I can name particular schools, but again, I think there are a number of resources out there, and one thing that the administration has done very helpfully is collect best practices that they've gotten from other schools. So I think everybody should take a look at the resources that are out there and available on the web and, you know, from the Department of Education, because there's a lot of guidance that is available to help schools make sure they're meeting their obligations.
And as we've been talking about, one idea here from the senators is that there is supposed to be federal aid, a withholding maybe of federal aid for colleges that are not in compliance with these laws we've been discussing. And I'm curious, in terms of sheer politics at universities, how contentious is this? How contentious would this be to have this more vigorously enforced?
Well, the Department of Education has stepped up enforcement quite a bit in the last few years. And I should also just mention that under the Clery Act, there are fines that can be imposed by the department.
But in terms of the withholding of funds in particular?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that is the ultimate stick that the federal government wields. And schools should take that very seriously, because if they don't negotiate and come into an agreement with the department who is investigating, you know, over 200 schools at this point, then they can be, you know, the funds can be taken away, or they could be the subject of a lawsuit by the Department of Justice. So I think because that is the ultimate penalty, schools typically do want to come into compliance.
Nina, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Nina Chaudhry, Education Director and Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. And she was with us to talk about a move from some senators to increase accountability for sexual assault on college campuses. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, political discussions can get pretty ugly, especially in an election year. We'll talk to the author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up.
Right now, an investigation into how Wisconsin treats sexual assault victims shows that they have to travel long distances and sometimes wait for hours to find nurses who can perform the correct forensic exams. These specially trained nurses aren't available in nearly half of Wisconsin counties, according to the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault.
Rory Linane is with us now. She's a Wisconsin storyteller for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. Rory, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
So what does a forensic nurse do that's different from a traditional nurse?
Sure. These nurses, they're called sexual assault nurse examiners, and they receive special training so that they can deal sensitively with victims of sexual assault, and they can do a forensic examination, which would include gathering evidence that can actually then be used in court in prosecution. And they will also do some medical assessments and help survivors access any medications they might need for sexually transmitted infections. And they can also connect victims with further resources in the community for healing.
As we mentioned just a little bit ago, in nearly half of Wisconsin's counties, there are not these specially trained nurses available. Why is there such a shortage? Why are there so few forensic nurses?
Yeah, well, the way the justice system is set up, it really relies on hospitals to step up and provide these exams, but the state doesn't require that hospitals provide them. And so because of some of the high costs associated with having examiner programs that aren't all reimbursable, hospitals either choose to not provide them at all, or if they do, it's often with foundational support as more of a charity service. So with a lot of hospitals just choosing not to provide those exams, it can be hard for women to get access to them, and men.
So it seems like these exams would be a critical part of being able to arrest someone for a sexual assault or to prosecute them. Is there a reason why this program is not, one, mandatory, and two, funded by criminal justice systems?
Mm-hmm. Well, the State Department of Justice does channel some funding for the exams. They pay for the cost of the actual exams, but there are other costs associated with that, such as the time that nurses spend on call that hospitals have to pay the nurses for, that there isn't currently funding for.
And in the people that you talked to and the information that you gathered, would you say that the wait and travel to see a forensic nurse is sometimes enough for victims to decide not to proceed with the investigation and getting examined?
I did hear that from advocates who work with victims, that it can be, you know, sometimes they just hit a wall. One person told me that she was with a victim at a hospital and they had waited several hours and then were told they had to go to another hospital. And she just said, I want to go home and be with my dog. And so, you know, you're dealing with people who've just gone through traumatic events, and sometimes that can be the last straw and they just don't go through with the exam.
It would also seem that the weight could also compromise the quality of the evidence that could be gathered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talked to a police detective about that, and she said that, you know, anything from going to the bathroom or washing up or changing clothes, which are things that you'd think a sexual assault victim might want to do, they either have to try not to do those things, or they do and they possibly compromise some of the evidence.
So as you just said, you spoke with detectives and case managers in writing your piece. What did they have to say about the availability of options for sexual assault victims in Wisconsin?
Well, they say that the options are just too slim right now, that, you know, having to travel out of your county and you know, wait for nurses to arrive is just a barrier that is causing women to not get access to the care or the options for prosecution that they might want.
And what kind of programs do exist around the state for people who are seeking this kind of treatment and examination after a sexual assault? Is it only hospital-based programs?
Yes, they're all in hospitals. There are some systems that have more robust programs than others. For example, I featured the Aurora Medical Center in Oshkosh, where they have 24-hour, 24/7 availability to do exams. And so, you know, a lot of police units in a county region around them know that Aurora can be a destination, and sometimes police will actually drive victims in from surrounding counties to that hospital.
But that, of course, is only happens when a victim actually feels comfortable reporting to the police,
right,
as well.
It's definitely not always the case.
We're talking with Rory Linane right now. She's a reporter and Wisconsin storyteller for the USA Today Network in Wisconsin. And we're talking about her piece that looks at the barriers for sexual assault victims being seen by a forensic nurse. Now, Rory, as we've been talking, this is a criminal justice issue besides a health issue. What has Attorney General Brad Schimel said about the availability of forensic nurses in the state?
Well, one of the problems is that it's hard to track how many are out there. The state doesn't do any central tracking of that. And so I asked him about that, and he said that's something that he would look into finding out why they don't do that and see if there is a way to do that. And he also mentioned that he'd like to try to find more federal grant dollars to cover some of the costs that hospitals are currently saddled with, such as transportation costs for nurses, so that they can send nurses to the nearest, most convenient location for the victim.
As we said earlier, half of Wisconsin's counties do not have a sexual assault nurse examiner in the county. Where is the distribution? Are there areas that are better served than others?
Urban areas tend to be better served than more rural and more sparsely populated areas. And part of the problem in those rural areas is that sexual assault is less prevalent just because you have less of a population. And so the nurses there can fall out of practice in their training. And so that's one of the recommendations that I heard from experts is trying to get more training options available so that nurses can keep their skills up to date even when they aren't actually seeing patients as often.
So it sounds like there are two layers of challenge there, getting nurses trained as these forensic nurses and then actually keeping them.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
You also, in your piece, look at measures that can be taken to expand the number of nurses with this specialized training and getting them into more areas of the state. And one of the suggestions was increasing the number of coordinators. Now, what do those coordinators do?
Yeah, those coordinators are in place to help nurses keep their training up to date and make sure that there's always someone available to do an exam. And also, the job can be emotionally draining for nurses. And so part of the role of the coordinator is to debrief with nurses after every exam and make sure that they're doing okay and have all of the resources they need. Because according to the State Department of Justice, they found that only about half of the nurses that have received this kind of training actually stick with the job for a full year after they've been trained. So the dropout rate is really high, and coordinators have been shown to be able to help nurses stay in the job for longer.
And you did say also that a concern is being able to stay, to feel like you're keeping your skills fresh and mm-hmm. sharp. What kind of refresher course or other kind of training could help keep these nurses in the field?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the International Association of Forensic Nurses has some recommendations on that, and they say it's important for nurses to have access to refresher courses that actually have live models come in that they can practice on to keep their skills up to date. And that's not something that Wisconsin currently offers, but some other states do have that.
And one of the issues that we've been talking about is that victims are having to travel great distances. Have there been any proposals or ideas for how to remove that obstacle?
Yes, so that was one of the things that Attorney General Schimmel brought up, was that instead of having victims move to the nearest, move to a hospital where there is a nurse, having the nurse actually move to the location closest to the victim. Also, I didn't get to fit this in my story, but there has been some talk about using telemedicine in this field so that nurses who might feel out of practice or unsure can actually video chat with an expert throughout the exam and make sure that they're doing everything correctly.
Oh, so the nurse, the sane nurse would actually be with the victim, but there might be a colleague who's joining in remotely.
Mm-hmm.
And as we wrap up, Rory, you said that Attorney General Schimmel has made a commitment to trying to find more funding and increase access throughout the state. Do you have a sense of what kind of timeline there might be for when more resources might become available to help these victims?
He did say that he would be looking to do something in this next upcoming budget. State budget.
And specifically looking for funding to help with training or transportation or?
Yeah, he mentioned that the only thing he mentioned specifically was with transportation, but he said he was interested in looking into the other options as well.
Well, Rory, thanks so much for being with us today. Well,
thanks so much for having me.
That was Rory Linane, reporter for USA Today Network, Wisconsin. She joined us to talk about her recent article on how Wisconsin makes sex assault victims wait.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a guest about why public discourse can be so toxic and what we might be able to do to change it. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Republican Congressman Reid Ribble isn't seeking re-election this year. We talk with him about his efforts at bipartisanship in Congress and his take on the candidacy of Donald Trump.
First, campaign season is in full swing as the nation prepares for the presidential election in November. There are a lot of important issues facing the nation, but toxic discourse often shuts down meaningful conversations. Here are just a few examples.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
A small, insecure money grubber who doesn't care who gets hurt so long as he makes a profit off it.
Susan Fluke, who goes before a congressional committee and essentially says that she must be paid to have sex. What does that make her? It makes her a slut, right?
The real reason that I'm recusing myself from voting for this bill, Mr. Speaker, is because it sucks. This bill sucks.
That was presumed Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, right-wing radio host Rush Limbaugh, and Wisconsin State Representative LaTanya Johnson from Milwaukee.
James Hogan joins us to talk about the toxic state of our public discourse and how he thinks we might be able to clean it up. He's the president of the Vancouver PR firm Hogan & Associates, chair of the David Suzuki Foundation Board, and founder of the website DSmog Blog. He's the author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, James, what got you thinking about discourse and how it has taken a turn for the toxic?
Well, it was actually I've been involved in environmental issues for a number of years, and it's always astonished me how we seem to, on so many of these issues like climate change and other issues like the state of the oceans, be listening to each other shout rather than listening to what the evidence is trying to tell us. And so I started interviewing people about that question and interviewing social scientists and so on, and quickly learned that it's not just the environment that has that problem. It's pretty much anything that's a kind of a big, important, contentious issue. And we seem to be so much better at polarizing than we are at finding common ground where the solutions usually lie.
And you're not just talking about politics here. We know there can be a lot of heightened rhetoric when it comes to politics, but you're talking about what you call the public square. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's the place where we have conversations about collective problems and challenges. And I'm a public relations person of 30 years, so in my country considered probably the most senior guy in this profession, if you want to call it that. And I think more and more over the last few years, I've seen the industry become more interested in attacking opponents than informing people. When I started out in the public relations business, it was a business of persuasion. And now it seems to be more and more as these big issues start we start to face issues like climate change and industries have difficulty making an argument. Instead of trying to make the argument, we end up in these kind of name-calling exercises. So politics has the worst part of politics has started to seep into other kinds of public discourse in communities.
What you're saying there reminds me of your conversation with Roger Connor, who was a lobbyist and a litigator, and he had an interesting story. It sounds like he started out, his MO was to identify the enemy, the person who would be labeled sort of evil, and then destroy that person or that message. And it was very effective for him, and all of a sudden he realized, you know, this isn't really that helpful all the time. Can you tell us a little bit about what he taught you?
Yeah, he's talked about something called the advocacy trap, and he said it's kind of where you end up when you have a name 'em, blame 'em, shame 'em approach to dealing with issues. And that what ends up happening is that, so say I care deeply about something, it could be environment, it could be some other kind of issue, and I speak up on it, I'm active on it, I'm participating in democracy and speaking up on behalf of a certain social group or environmental problem or whatever, and someone disagrees with me. We seem to be quite quick to assume that people who don't agree with us are that they're either stupid or they're up to something. And before we know it, we move from thinking that they're wrong to thinking that they're wrongdoers and feeling like we're in a battle between good and evil, and I'm David and they're Goliath, and you start to have feelings of self-righteousness. And when you start to feel self-righteousness, it's easy to justify damn near anything, is what Connor says. And I think that's true. You end up in this state where you're just in a perpetual fight, and the fight becomes more important than the issue. And winning and defeating the person on the other side starts to dominate. And then when people look at the issue from the outside, the general public, they just see, one person on one side of the issue, another person on the other side of an issue, neither one of them willing to budge an inch, and so they just turn off. And so we find ourselves in that situation on such a wide range of issues today that I think we need to go back and start to look at some of these skills that we've had in the past of finding common ground, because I think that's where we all know common sense tells us that the solutions lie. No one's going to kind of dominate everything and make the world in their values without and totally ignore other people. I mean, we need to learn how to work with people that we disagree with and even people we don't like.
We're talking with James Hogan right now. He's the author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. And looking at common ground, I mean, it's a term everybody knows, but what we don't know is necessarily how to find it. It's easier to stake out opposing corners on an issue. What do you suggest based on your research about how to begin to get toward that place of common ground?
I think some of it's really simple. I mean, it's just as simple as assuming that people who disagree with you aren't necessarily, that their intentions aren't necessarily bad. That good people can do bad things for good reasons. And it's not only other people who can be under the influence of bias and be wrong. We can also have that problem. We're all, as human beings, subject to the forces of bias that we may not be aware of.
Are we fighting against the way we're wired at all when it comes to that? I mean, it sounds as though, in some ways, our brains are wired to want to protect our beliefs, and we want to justify ourselves when we think we're right, even if that means maybe twisting the truth a little bit.
Yeah, that's true, and I think tribalism or community, if you want to give it a softer term, is like that. You know, there's huge benefits to being part of a community, to being part of a team, but there's also drawbacks. You know, we naturally unite into teams, we divide against other teams, but we also, in doing that, can become blinded to the truth, and we can start to, when evidence comes along that sort of contradicts the beliefs of our community, we can get ourselves into the habit of actually changing the evidence rather than changing our minds, right? So I think it's part of it is just an awareness of the shortcomings that we have as human beings and as our communities have, and being more open-minded, and maybe even holding our beliefs lightly, which is advice that Carol Tavris, a psychologist who wrote Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, some advice that she gave me. And I think that's very good advice, holding our beliefs lightly.
You have a chapter in your book on gaslighting from the famous movie where someone is made to believe that they're crazy. They're not really. And you talk about how this can be applied to this same argument about discourse. How does gaslighting figure in?
Gaslighting is this, I didn't realize this, but it's actually a term of art in psychology where people can start to lose confidence and in their own perception and become really dependent on the person who may be working for them to lose their confidence in the way they see the world. And you can do that on a mass scale. One of the people that I interviewed in the book talked about it and actually wrote a book about it. And you can get, it's basically the manipulation of fear, and basically using people's fear against, to undermine their reasoning and to get them to do things that aren't necessarily in their interest. This kind of thing actually happens. People in my business more and more use social science to design communication strategies. And sometimes those communication strategies are just used to disrupt the conversation, to sort of undermine public discourse.
What's an example of that? Just a quick example. But
climate change denial. It's basically, there was a massive program that was undertaken by a number of industry organizations that the sole purpose was to convince people that it was junk science and that the science wasn't reliable or that it was biased or that it was hokey. But what was happening there was an exercise in actually trying to change the meaning of the science and add a kind of a partisan meaning to the science of climate change. And so it became not is the science reliable, but this isn't something that people like you and I believe in. If you do believe in this, then you're not part of this team. You must be part of that team. And that's not how normally we should be processing information.
James Hogan's with us right now. He's the author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Why do you think public discourse has gotten so toxic? What do you think needs to be done to clean it up? How do you make sure your conversations stay productive, especially when you're talking about politics or other hot-button issues? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with James Hogan. He's the author of the book, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up.
And we're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to happen to clean up our discussion of important issues like climate change? Why do you think the public square has gotten so polluted with misinformation and toxic discussions? Do you think it's possible to clean up our public discourse? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take our first caller now. We've got Chad on the line in Dubuque, Iowa. Chad, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
So I guess my point was, or my comment is, I think it's important to find out what your areas of agreement are with somebody that you're having a debate or a disagreement with. And just to give one small, quick example, like with instance to the conflict in Israel-Palestine, you can find out, you know, something that you agree on, that maybe there are people over there that's suffering and something has to be done about it. It's just a matter of then working out the differences in either who's at fault or how you might fix it. I guess that's sort of it.
Chad, thank you for the call. And Jim, tell us about finding that common ground initially, especially, I mean, that's Israel-Palestine. That's a difficult one. In situations that are that fraught, how do you begin?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. This idea that just acknowledging another person's point of view or trying to find something in their point of view that you agree on can kind of start the conversation so that it is a conversation rather than just a monologue. And I think what the caller said is exactly right, that this idea that I think probably on most issues we agree on most things. There may be like 25% of the area that we have problems with, but when we're really right in the middle of the most combative part of that 25%, it's hard to see the other 75% or 80% of issues that we may agree on. And so I think a lot of the time, for me, it may not always be that there's common ground, but I think there is a lot more common ground than we think. And you want to, if you're not going to find common ground with somebody, at least you should know why. And it shouldn't be because for tribal reasons.
Hmm. Well, thank you. Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think I finished. But it shouldn't be for tribal reasons. And it should be conscious. And so I think trying to explore common ground and things that you agree on can actually start a conversation where you can actually start to realize that the person isn't an idiot because they disagree with you, right, on the other side of the argument.
Right, getting back to the title of your book, I mean, you're basically saying it's an ironic title, that no one's an idiot, we just haven't figured out the common ground yet, it sounds like.
Well, I'm not saying that no one is an idiot.
Oh, so some people are idiots.
I think there's far fewer idiots than we think. And I think assuming that somebody is an idiot is probably a big mistake.
Not a good starting point either. Okay, well, let's go to our next caller. We've got Chance with us in Osseo. Hi, Chance.
Hello there. Very wise words coming from your guest, and I appreciate the conversation. What I wanted to say, you were speaking on the dangers of self-righteousness, and I'll admit I am a self-righteous person, and I have a difficulty avoiding that. In particular, in the example that he brought up on the subject of climate change, when your, I won't say opponent, though I very often view it that way, but your fellow citizen in discourse refuses to acknowledge what are commonly held as facts, where do you go from there and in a conversation, and how could you possibly avoid becoming self-righteous in a situation like that?
Okay, thanks, Chance. Good question. And Jim?
Yeah, great question. And one of the people that I interviewed was this French intellectual, Bruno Latour, and he talks about this very specifically, that his feeling is that we need to stop arguing about facts, who's got the bigger facts, and start to shift the conversation from arguments about facts to conversations about concerns.
What's wrong with conversations about facts? Because it seems like, I mean, the fact is supposed to be something that you can prove, I guess, with physical knowledge, with science, and therefore it should be something that's sort of beyond positions.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea and probably works okay when we were in university. But in the real world, we have facts are sticky, difficult things. They're not just totally objective. In fact, most facts are subjective. And so what's a fact and what's not a fact, and is it my fact or your fact? These things can be the source of huge amounts of discord. And they don't, you can look at it in the climate change debate, they don't actually clear up the debate. So the concern is not that facts aren't important. Of course they're important. We want to have evidence-based policies. But it's more that arguing about facts doesn't actually move forward towards solutions as smoothly as we think. In fact, I think you can endlessly argue about facts with somebody who doesn't think climate change is happening. It's just there's no use in it because they're not going to change their minds. But you could actually get people who don't want to admit that climate change is a problem to even agree to price carbon or to, you know, put in place clean energy solutions. So as long as you're not imperialistically requiring that before we have an agreement on moving forward with good policy that that person admit they're wrong, that you can actually maybe get something done.
Well, thanks a lot for bringing that up, Chance. Appreciate that. And Jim, you didn't just speak with sort of philosophers and scientists. You spoke with people in the spiritual realm. You spoke with the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh. What did they have to add?
Well, Thich Nhat Hanh was just amazing. Well, so was the Dalai Lama. But I'll just tell you one moment from both of those. So I spent an afternoon with Thich Nhat Hanh with David Suzuki, who's a Canadian scientist and environmental advocate. And Thich Nhat Hanh was telling David that we needed to bring meditation into the work to protect the environment. And he was talking about inner ecology. And I started to think, like, is he just saying we shouldn't be advocates? So I said, you know, I know that your monks and nuns in Vietnam posted these pictures of police on the website, the police that were harassing the monastery. Now, that seems to me to be advocacy. You're not suggesting that environmental advocacy is a bad thing, that we shouldn't be advocates, are you? And he looked at me and he said, speak the truth, but not to punish.
And what did you take away from that?
I think it is that we want to speak up against injustice, and we must, but not in a way that causes more hatred or that unnecessarily personalizes the issue that you're talking about. And it sort of ties in with what the Dalai Lama said to me, which was, you know, at the end of the interview, he pointed at my forehead and he said, we like to think the Western mind is more sophisticated, but I think that the Tibetan heart might be stronger. Maybe if we take the Western mind and the Tibetan heart and we join them together, we may be able to fix some of these problems. We were talking about climate change. And what he was talking about is warm-heartedness and empathy, which translates into, you know, respect or just being more human with other people who disagree with us so that we're, you know, as one of the callers said earlier, looking for things that we have in common and not making these sort of assumptions about people's moral fiber or their intelligence.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
That was James Hogan with us, the president of the Vancouver PR firm Hogan & Associates. His new book is called I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. This is Central Time.
Art is imitating life these days, at least when it comes to a couple of well-known celebrities.
The debonair Matthew McConaughey is going back to school, not as a student, but as a professor. He'll be teaching a filmmaking class at his alma mater, the University of Texas, Austin. In an official video, the university said, good luck getting into the class. It's going to fill up fast.
And for fans of the TV show Chips, the actor Eric Estrada was just sworn in as a reserve officer for the St. Anthony Police Department in Idaho. He played the motorcycle-riding, fast-talking character Ponch. Now he'll be working in the new Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force.
And Judith, you told me that the Chips era was your era.
It was my era.
You were the prime demographic.
I was a preteen and early teen girl.
And were you a Ponch super fan?
Super fan might be strong. I definitely had a little crush on Eric Estrada. Definitely more my type than his sidekick. But it was a good show. And that was back when you had to know when a show was on to watch it. And so, yeah, we would be ready to watch.
And now he's a real police officer in Idaho.
Doing pretty cool stuff. It sounds like
it does. Well, this is Central Time and the theme from Chips.